Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to After Things, the show that comes after Weird Things, but we tend to talk more about what you can do as a creative professional, what we're trying to do as creative professionals, and you don't have to be a professional to be a creative and looking for professional applications for this. You could be a writer, you could be a podcaster, you could be somebody who makes things with your hands, you could be a person trying to find out what you want to do, and I don't know that we'll be that helpful, but we'll try. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Heck yeah, man. We can't promise that we'll be professional or useful or helpful or even make you feel better about yourself. Pretty sure you're going to hear two idiots blathering on. Did I sell it well?
Jump right in. We decided to start a thing called Weird Tank, where people could send in their ideas, things they want to do, and have us try to help them out and give them some of our input on it. And we are not licensed business advisors. We are basically carnies. And take that with a grain of salt. We're still figuring things out. I've made a bunch of mistakes. Sometimes some of our success is not because of our efforts. It's been despite of it. So,
heck yeah.
Let's start off here. The first one we have here is from Will Silver. He writes, "Make me an author," from Will. "Here's my situation. I'm trying to become an author. I've managed to do a book, O'Connor's Ruled Over a NaNoWriMo. I placed it on Amazon. It turns out I've been bitten by the bug. Since then, I've produced 5 more books, ranging subject from cool transport operator on the moon who's been involved with murder and the crashing of an asteroid, a steampunk version of Phineas Fogg, kind of a turn of the century Tony Stark, traveling around the solar system in 80 days, to the first book in the series about girls in the 1920s with similar names, team like Encyclopedia Brown and 3 Investigators. Says, I've been plagued with stops and starts with beta readers and editors. Lost 3 editors in the last 6 months. I'm fed up with the prospect of waiting for more work, which, let's be honest, will not be perfection. I've got some money to invest in a podcast for advertising and a lot of work to do. So the plan stands at some point using software, Hemingway, etc., as a grammar checker and some advice for my family. I'm going ahead. As I said, I have a bit of cash, but not to pay a mainline editor. Other people are happy to help, but do not when they allow things like work to get in the way. I know this passion, expecting anyone to take it seriously, kind of like this, but I should not take over. But should I not take over 5 months to edit 100,000K of words, right? All right, let me scan through here. Trying to figure out, get to the question here.
I mean, it sounds like he's asking for what direction to take his work. We've heard a bit about what he's done so far and what his plans are. I got to be honest, the only thing that really threw up a red flag instantly for me was hearing I have some money set aside to start a podcast, and podcasting is essentially free. I mean, you're looking at maybe $100 of total startup costs to have a decent USB microphone. Everything else is free software and your time. I would not spend, certainly don't give your money to anyone else to handle the podcasting side of anything for you. Do it yourself, do it right now, do it right away. I do understand the point about you're sitting around waiting on beta readers, you know, your friends and family to get around to giving you feedback. The problem is you're expecting them to do editor's work when they're not being paid editor's salary or doing editor's anything. I suspect that you would do much better to head on over to some kind of online forum with like-minded creators, people who are hungry to start their stuff, and you can trade your time to read their work and give good editing in exchange for them to do yours. Family is a great place to start, but family is not going to be very likely to give you an appropriate amount of time or an appropriate level of advice because they love you. And when they love you, they want you to continue to love them, which means you're not going to hear what you need to hear about your writing from family members. You will hear what you need to hear about your writing from your peers or from your prospective audience. And if you don't have a mailing list and you don't have people lined up who actually want to read every word that you have, then you got to go find some of your peers that you can trade editing proposals with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm gonna break some things down here because you have one book up on Amazon, and I'm looking. I guess this is a children's book. It's listed in children's book. It's 100 because I'm looking at it's 173 pages, which isn't does not appear to be novel sized. So this would be, let's say, novella. And I've not read your stuff. I don't know what your audience is or what they're. And I would say that often the problem we've had myself has been is I have some things that are ready for people and some things that are not ready for people. And I know that when I have a problem getting my friends to read stuff, it's not for them, either because it's not for them or it's not as good as some of my other stuff. And that tends to be a warning flag for me personally. If I say, hey, do you get it? I'm like, oh, yeah, I started it. I'll get back to it. And I'm like, ah, okay. If I get – I read it in one night, I know I'm onto something good. If I'm getting – yeah, I'm getting through it. I'm getting through it. I'm like, they're not reading it for fun. They're reading it for as a favor. And I tend to overread on that. I mean, I tend to read too much into that. But that might be a sign that maybe the story needs to be tighter. Maybe you need to do another polish or draft on it. Maybe you need to go sit through there. So – I don't know that's the case for you, but I'm saying that is often a case for me and for other people is that we're having initial getting things to launch with our own friends and our own circles can be problematic because it's not good. That can be a problem. Not to say that it can't be good or it won't be good, but it maybe isn't starting from there. And that's – nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to be told that. It's one of the reasons why I don't read other people's stuff. Because I guarantee you 90% of the stuff that people want to send me is not good. And I don't want to be the person – I should not be the person to tell them, you know, that. And there was a time years ago when I wrote that it was not good stuff because I was just trying to explain ideas and I wasn't trying to tell a story or show a story. And I had to go through that. So he, in your case here, I'm going to say start point is are you sure you have a bunch of ideas. You're doing a bunch of different things. Have you really delivered a really good first point? I'm going to go to a presentation this week at Fox Studios, all about Mars. It's put on by 20th Century Fox, and one of the main speakers is going to be Andy Weir. Okay,
and you think about it, like Andy Weir is like he's only written one book. Yeah, he wrote the book. The book, the most exciting book and interesting, captivating book in recent history involving space in a not far off science fiction point of view, because he did his homework. He did an extreme amount of research in there. And you've heard me nitpick little things in there, but I am passionately in love with what that guy has done, what he's created. He created a great book, a fantastic book that he gets to write on for a long time. And not to say that we all have to try to do that, but that shows when you put a lot of effort into something and it reads that that's where you should go. And I'm guilty of creating stuff very quickly, doing a little bit of patching and putting tape and some spackle on it and then being like, all right, ready to go. And I've been able to write off of that to an extent, but you got to be careful, you know. And that's my advice here is to say, okay, make one really great thing, put your effort into it, figure out, you know, why are you having resistance? It might just be that your friends aren't readers. It might be problematic. Solve that problem. Do as Brian says, find groups of other people to read your stuff and give you notes. Open yourself up to criticism, because if you open yourself up to criticism and let people tear you apart who have something to say of meaning and you can endure that, you become a better writer. Once you're pretty solid that it is a good story, because you're getting feedback from people, not just people who are telling you because they like you and they want to make sure that you still like them, but you're getting good independent feedback that this is a really solid story. You want to get it edited. That's problematic. That's that, you know, and Hemingway and other systems I'm not familiar with. I'm doing a crowdsource edit on my next book, Station Breaker, where I send everything out to my email list. I said, anybody wants to take a look at it? And then send me your corrections. I've got over 500 entries into a Google Forms database that I have to sort through to do an edit on this book. But I can tell you, I don't know if it's going to be any more pain-free than when I get my book back from my editor at HarperCollins, my other book for the next Jessica Blackwood novel from Hannah, who's my fantastic editor there. That is a humiliating, ego-suffocating experience to have to go through every single page, has red lines going through just about every sentence or whatever that I have to redo. But that's the other – I can't get away from it. It's going to happen either way. So write the book. Make it the best book you can do. get your friends to read it, and then get as many, give away as many free copies as you can.
Agreed.
So, moving right along. Okay, so podcast about a town from Braden. I've had this idea for over a year, but I've never gotten off the ground. I want to do what you guys do for weird things, specifically for my small little town in Illinois. This would be a YouTube show podcast. Essentially, what I'm thinking is my niche I can podcast about is my town. How do I take this and make it a business? I'd love to quit. I'd love to quit my day job and just go fully on this, but insurance costs is always what holds me back. How does the After Things think tank AT purpose I turn this into a full business? Is there a full business? Is there a full business there?
Well, okay. So here's the thing. The reason the internet works is because you can be very, very specific in your content focus, right? We are fairly general in that we're just news of the weird, everything from goblins to the supernatural to, you know, SpaceX and so on. That's a fairly broad thing. If you want to, you can make a podcast just about the credit sequences for AMC dramas, and you can get the people who make the credit sequences and break them down. You know, there's a podcast out there called Sound Exploder, where the guy takes, you know, it gets people who create music, they break out all the tracks, and they talk about why everything works. The reason these things work is because they are extremely specific in content purpose and focus, but they're completely devoid of regional restrictions. You can find, all you need is you know, we'll say 500 people who really care enough to donate some money to a Patreon, and you can do this thing for the rest of your life, but you got to find that 500 people. To have the best chance of finding them, you have to look worldwide. If you want to do weird things, which already, spoiler alert, has about 500 patrons worldwide, and then say, yeah, I want that subject matter. But instead of searching for the entire world for 500 people, I just want to limit my content to only be relevant to folks within 100 miles of where I happen to podcast. I'm going to say, let's say you're exactly as good as Weird Things. Let's say you're exactly as has the reach of Weird Things, but you make it regionally focused. You could be lucky to find 5 people going it that way.
We're gonna break down the problems for it, and then we'll tell you what our the upside is. Weird Things is a podcast that took off largely because Brian already had a really big audience from having done Scam School for years and then going off and doing an NSFW show. And so he brought a lot of people in. I had an audience for having written magic books for years, and so I could bring in my loyal magic fans and following in there. Justin has an audience because he's just an awesome human being, and that's where we have this. We had 3 factors coming in to build this together. Even still, I would say that our download rates, like maybe 10 or 15,000, which is huge in some respects, but it's still not colossal. And out of that, we have 500 people who make this thing happen for us, but nobody's living off of what we do from this podcast. We do this podcast because Sundays, we love to hang out and talk about this stuff, you know? And so, and we are absolutely grateful for the people who make this, you know, who support us and do Patreon for this, because it makes it very easy to say, yeah, no, I got to go do this Sunday because people are counting on it, you know, but it's, you know, when you listen to podcasts all day long and you hear people who are making money and supporting themselves from doing that, you're not in a accurate view of how the world works. You're not as paying as much attention necessarily to the thousands of podcasts that don't make any money, that don't get by, that aren't doing anything, and even things that look like successes, like Brian pointed out, you know, those, some of those great videos and stuff, and, you know, point out the economics. How many podcasts does Brian do? Brian, how many podcasts do you do a week?
Regularly, it's Weird Things, Cord Killers, Night Attack, Scam School. I guess you could throw After Things in there. Now we're doing Modern Rogue, and then on top of that, there was TV shows. But keep in mind, my career is built on the graveyard of projects that didn't pan out. Going back to Game On, the Camtina Band, BB Live Show, Brian Brushwood on the Road, DIAF. I mean, there's no shortage of products that we or projects that we picked up and got the experience from. I'm thrilled that we did it. I think it's a good experience to build and keep testing what's gonna work. But yeah, man, you gotta whiff a lot of balls before you hit a home run.
And now, all the balls you're keeping in the air. You know, how many shows does Tom Merritt do? You know, no single podcast would support your lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? I mean, granted, you live in a very big house. You have a, you know, you're a very big family and all that. You know, if you wanted to live much more modestly, of course, not that you're, you know, burning $100 bills on the barbecue grill, you know, but the point is that you're a very successful guy. You know, you have a very nice way of life. You've done very, you're accomplished. You won. Brian won, but Brian is also.
I'm getting very uncomfortable right now, but keep going.
you don't necessarily see it. You know, you're in a different point of view. Okay. But to all the rest of us, we see what a success you are, but you're working your ass off all the time because not one of these podcasts is enough to be able to sustain the lifestyle that you're at, whatever. Even your, you know, you have a big goddamn YouTube gold button, you know, which, you know, if you were a single guy out there on the make, you know, that show would be good, but you're a guy building an enterprise. So the idea that one podcast, you know, unless your name's, you know, Mark Maron, you know, and even then, it's not. It's
well,
just
and,
not.
And that brings up a really good point because in their book, Freakonomics, Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner propose that, you know, one of the questions, and forgive me if we've talked about this before, but they ask, you know, if movie stars are all rich in the Hollywood Hills, how come so many of them are serving me coffee? If drug dealers are making so much money, how come so many of them are living with their moms? And the answer they came up with is both of those are places where at the very top you can make a sick amount of money, but for everyone else, it is a tournament, and it's extremely unlikely that you will make it to the very top of that tournament. However, having said that, when I was a kid, I remember watching an interview with Kevin Bacon for, I want to say it was Tremors. It was probably something before then. But Kevin Bacon was already established to me as a Hollywood superstar. So I was surprised when, I forget what the question is, but his answer was, because I'm not very good. You know, there are people who are inherently talented, and I'm somebody who just has to work harder and do more projects in order to get those hits that to happen. I have to play the numbers and I have to play, you know, I have to work harder than everyone else. And I remember thinking that something about that struck a chord with me. And I'll say, Scam School is far and away the biggest property that we've done. Having said that, it's maybe 14 or 1200 in the world out of all subscription counts. And certainly we don't make those automatic. As soon as we release a video, it does a million views the way someone like a Veritasium or a Vsauce or someone else will do. But for what we do is we do a significant number of base hits on a regular basis. And likewise, as thrilled and proud as I am of what we're doing with Weird Things, you know, it's not exactly like we're winning the tournament of iTunes podcasting. Same thing with Night Attack. But what we do have is an extraordinarily dedicated following who are able to, between all of them in this highly diversified portfolio, we're able to make enough to keep this whole operation going and growing. I mean, everything, mm-hmm. That's the exciting thing is that by playing the numbers and working harder than everyone else, we're able to be just slightly better than the crowd and have this, it's sort of like a, you know, back to the Weird Things episode, it doesn't matter if your space balloon is only slightly gravity positive or positive buoyancy compared to the atmosphere or wildly positive buoyancy to the atmosphere. All that matters is that if you're moving upward, just make sure to get as much material as you can to elevate it. Does that make sense? That was like five metaphors in one.
Yeah, I think that it's challenging. And it's funny because you'll see like, I don't want to get like too crazy political, but you'll see like celebrities talking about like, you know, the argument like, you know, should Jennifer Lawrence got paid as much as Bradley Cooper or this or whatever? And then there's arguments to be made about that. And obviously there are a lot of biases in the industry is how those, you know, those things work. But then you're hearing like, yeah, so-and-so only got $6 million compared to $10 million. Yeah, see that girl sitting behind her on set when they're in that shopping mall who's pretending to talk to her friend? Yeah, they got $80 that day and they were trying to take as many rolls as they could from the food services cart because – they're trying to make it in this business and they are never, ever going to be in a position to argue about, you know, how many, and it's funny because it's like, there's this one discussion here, but it's like the economics of this business are not what people realize. you know the vast number of people here barely getting by trying to make it in the business. You know, the most, you know, you talk about income inequality from listening from movie stars who literally make, you know, 100,000 times as much as the other person on set.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude. Yeah, no, I agree. All right. Do we have time for a third one? Do we have another contender?
I have time. But I would just say, do the podcast because you love it, put passion to it, and maybe it'll work. But, you know, we've seen, you know, Justin can talk to you about, talk ad nauseum about local journalism and how that's not even a market that really works for local television in some regards. So it's do it because you love it, and then look for ways to make it happen. If you do it because this is going to be a business right out the bat, it ain't. It's just not. And then you might find opportunities. But, you know, public access television is riddled with corpses of people who thought they were going to have something that were going to be local and be bigger. Feedback on Tea Time podcast from Ken. I've recently started a single mic podcast. I'm hoping this podcast will, one, help me be more comfortable on a mic. Two, be a good testing bed for new stand-up material. I've recently been hitting the open mics. Three, be a creative outlet. I'm a developer a day, database stuff. Four, be a potential promotional vehicle for other creative endeavors. I also write fiction. The thing is, I wonder if I've done myself a disservice with the name and format of the podcast. I've divided the podcast into three segments, the first being loosely related to whichever tea I happen to be drinking. I was hoping the listener would feel as though we were sitting together for tea in a nice chat about the Super Friends or some other tomfoolery. I want to differentiate from the many other nerd culture themed podcasts out there and wonder if I played up the tea angle too much. I've had people respond with, yeah, I'm more of a coffee guy, and they hear about my podcast. Should I rebrand as something more generic, like Nerd Talk with Ken, or stay the course, the Today's Tea with Kenny P? What about something like The Nerdist? You know, something like The Nerdist, is that taken? Also, any tips on building a community around this thing?
Here's the thing. Names can matter for major releases when you are going to be exposed to a lot of people all at the same time. When you're very small, the name almost matters not at all. It is a blank slate onto which you can project whatever the content actually is. You know, Weird Things is a very descriptive name. I don't know that the show or our following would be much different if it was called The Fifth Room or, you know, whatever reference to some kind of inside thing it is, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that if your show is a lot about tea and it's this other thing, people who don't care about tea aren't going to sit around to get to the rest of it. It's niche, and it certainly there can be people who are going to share with you the same interest, but it's the same pod problem as the other podcast. Is you've got a small town, the number of people, I'm going to make everybody dizzy as I move this around. You've got a small town, and the number of people who are going to be interested in that to watch this or listen to this in a small town is going to be extremely limited unless there's appeal elsewhere. If I listen to this thing, it's about, you know, a nerd talking about tea and then talking about this other stuff. And also, that's every podcast now. That's every podcast is this nerd culture stuff. And how do you can be different, but it doesn't mean it's interesting. I'm not a tea drinker, so yeah, if it's about tea, then it's a good name. If it's not about tea, then maybe, but there's a lot of
Well, so here's the thing. You can do well if you look and you feel like tea people are nuts and you know something about tea drinkers that we don't. Like, oh, tea people are nuts. They love it. They can't get enough of all this stuff. And nobody's serving with a proper tea podcast. Then, yeah, by all means, go for it. Link it in there. But realize that you're making a Venn diagram and that you will live in the intersection of stuff. So, you know, if let's say Weird Things rebranded as Weird Things, the number one place for people who like Sasquatch and Bigfoot and who love four-wheel drive vehicles. All of a sudden you've taken what was a very wide base of appealing, and instead you've taken, you know, but also, you know, you have to identify as a four-wheel drive vehicle enthusiast, and you've limited yourself. So evaluate how important the T angle is and figure out if maybe there's not something that'll appeal to a wider base, or at least something that has a built-in passion for it that can draw people.
Yeah, and the tea can be a little hook, but like, hey, today's podcast brought to you by, I only know one tea, you know, Earl Grey, you know, I like this because of that. Now, right into the story, you know, and that will be people who aren't tea drinkers might think, oh, that might be interesting, you know, but yeah, figure out what it's about. I think we should do one more because this is a good one, and it's Magic Live Show, Magic Science Live Show from Ben. Hey guys, the After Things podcast has helped me start thinking about what I want to do in the future. So I thought I'd throw this out for your response. I'm in my early 30s and I decided that in 10 years' time, I want to be a professional science communicator. I'm still fairly open to how that may come about, but I have some ideas. I only have a high school education, but plan on expanding that as part of my goal. One thought I've had is to do a stage show that centers around science. I'm thinking along the lines of the magic of science, and was really inspired by the format of Brian's Fire Eating Act. So what things would you recommend that I do to work towards that? I'm in Seattle and begun volunteering at the Seattle Aquarium and plan to also volunteer at the Pacific Science Center once I've had some time at the aquarium. I've seen this as getting myself used to having an audience and grabbing people who have a mild interest in a given subject and really hooking them. What other kinds of places would you recommend I start looking into to start building the very bottom foundation of what I need to even put an act together in the first place? Also, what other organizations do you recommend that would help build toward my long-term goal of increasing the public awareness and understanding of science?
Good question.
I'll jump in.
Yeah, please.
So, number one, if you want to start getting more active in public speaking about science and you're still in your early 30s and you mentioned education, yes, continue that. Continue on in your education to do that. You know, it doesn't mean you have to get a grad. You know, Bill Nye, the science guy, has an undergraduate degree in engineering. Everybody thinks of him as a scientist because he's very knowledgeable about a wide variety of topics and capable of talking about it. So just expand, keep doing that. Keep in that process. The aquarium's great. By all means, the Pacific Science Center is really good. The Sidewalk Astronomers is another good one. Every science place there is, and Seattle has a lot of them, get involved in those groups. You're going to have a lot of astronomy clubs. There's going to be other groups there, and they're always doing public stuff and looking for volunteers. I say go do those things because you'll learn how they do their regular public presentations. You're going to be aware of where are the places that have these public presentations go on, and you're going to get a lot of practical experience talking about science to regular people and have a good idea of what are they hooked in, what are they interested in, how do I do a show that kindergartners will like and adults will like. Then you'll start getting understanding about doing school shows, et cetera. So look for every local science and educational outreach. Are there nature centers in Seattle? There are. Go to the nature centers. Find out about being a nature center volunteer. You know, get as much practical experience as you can out there in doing these public programs as you can, and then start building towards what you want to do on what you have.
And along those lines, from a different angle, if your goal is to get to a full program, let's say a 40 or 30 minute program, a full program is built out of 3 to 5 minute segments. And the nice thing about variety entertainment is that you could pull out a single stunt and tell a single story for it. You know, in the case of, you know, the fire eating, you know, I wanted something that could establish me as an expert that very early on would grab everyone's attention and put me in a place where I could talk and not have to be funny, and yet still get people entranced and built in. Once I had it, I wrote that routine, I would go to the university and perform it at the pseudoscience and the paranormal class. I would go to open mic nights and perform it. And it was only that 5 minutes, like, hey, it's difficult to book an entire 30 to 45 minute program and have an audience there. 5 minutes, everybody will give you 5 minutes. Just say, hi, I'm so-and-so from the local science thing. I'd like to do a short presentation and tell people the history of, you know, fossilization with a cool demonstration. And then you jump in and you do it. Everyone will give you 5 minutes and you need the flight time because there's no amount of running through the script in your bedroom that will accomplish. You could do that 100 times and you'll learn more the very first time you get up in front of a real crowd and perform the exact same thing. So I say, break it into pieces, figure out a million different places to get flight time for those individual pieces, and then sit down and structurally say, okay, what is the story that I'm telling with each of these individual bits?
And what's your story? You know, what is your story? And don't be ashamed to be a citizen scientist. Citizen science is important. It's critical. It's absolutely, you know, there's value to that being there. And you don't have to just say, well, I think this is cool. Go out and do science. Don't just talk about it. Go do some science too. Be involved with people communicating science. Get involved with people who are trying to do interesting stuff, whether it could be environmental stuff, whether it can be, you know, doing, you know, universities are often looking for volunteers to help do stuff when they want to go out into the field and do that. Go out there and do it too. That's one of my biggest problems with this F yeah science mentality is there are a lot of people who think because they watch, you know, a few documentaries and, you know, they're happy to cheer on the stuff, but they have no practical experience with science when they could, when they can actually go understand a little bit deeper of it and really understand what's going on. And it might change their opinion of some of the stuff. So get some experience.
Absolutely, man. Dude, I feel like we changed a lot of lives. We solved a lot of problems, and we sat there like smug jerks on our thrones proclaiming, giving prescriptions that we don't ever have to find out if we were right or wrong on.
I know. Crushed a lot of dreams. It's what we do.
Welcome to After Tank.
I have a pick.
Okay.
Brian.
Yes.
This is a question to you.
Okay.
Did you see Grease live?
No, I didn't. Should I have?
You can still see it.
Okay.
It's on Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
As an entertainer. Now, they shot this. So what they did, Grease Live, was Fox decided to do a production of both the movie and elements from the original play live on TV, shot not even a mile away from my house over at the studios over right across, you know, down the street from me. They shot it there. 3-hour production starring Juliana Huff, Vanessa Hudgens, an amazing cast of people. Carly Rae Jepsen, she was fantastic. Really, really, really neat production of it. They used 21 different sets to put this thing off, shot entirely in real time. It opened up with a great number by Jessie J. She did the title song, Grease is the Word, moving through the back lot there. It rained during part of it, so they just gave them umbrellas. There's a really cool clip here, which is where they cut. They juxtapose.
Now, did they do this when it was live, or this is just some other – this is some behind-the-scenes stuff?
So, one of the assistant directors uploaded a footage of what was going on in the control room as she's calling the different shots. It's not actually – it's not cutting to what she's saying, so it's a different take. This is like the live production on the left, but and then what's going on in the studio.
Yeah, she's calling out camera shots, camera movements, stage blocking things.
So, by the way, I think this is exactly what you need if broadcast media is to survive. This is something that is electric that you can only get through live traditional broadcast media that you can't replicate on the internet and certainly won't feel the same if you're not watching it live. I think this is a way to create, the next sporting event.
It is. I'm not a musical guy. Let me make that very clear. And so I don't have a lot of knowledge of musicals or whatever. But I'm a guy who studies, fascinated by theater, fascinated by live performances, fascinated by that aspect of it. And what they did technically was incredible. They mixed a live audience with, you know, a production, again, 20 sets, cameras moving around. There are shots that go across the entire studio and into a building. What they did as far as there's changes there where the Grease Lightning, that junky car becomes the Grease Lightning car. What seems like in split seconds, but it's actually, you know, through the magic of misdirection and stuff. Amazing from a technical point of view, really good performances. And if you have any interest in live performing at all, I highly recommend you check out Grease Live.
Right on. Man, I don't have a pick of a similar caliber. I really got nothing outside of to say, you could watch the FX channel, which is what I did on vacation. I watched old-fashioned live cable television. And remember that? It's crazy. They got lots of shows. That's it.
That works. Well, Grease Lightning, everybody.
Right on.
Brian?
Yo.
It's been After.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.